So in San Francisco is a little bit different than other cities, right? Because, you know, San Francisco is really more in a defensive place, if we want to be honest, right? San Francisco is trying to defend and maintain its presence as being a tech capital, whereas other cities around the country and around the globe are getting ready to potentially be the next San Francisco. So for San Francisco, I think we have a couple issues at hand. Number one is it is very untenuous and difficult to survive in San Francisco and to get the kind of quality of life in San Francisco that folks are able to get in some of these other emerging cities. A big part of that is housing affordability. We are, as a state, 49th in housing production. There is only one state in all of America that produces less housing, and that's Utah. So we just have such a drastic housing issue in San Francisco that we've been talking about it for years, but it is the number one thing that we need to address if we want to be able to grow the ecosystem so that workers can actually live and thrive in the city. 70% of tech workers cannot afford to buy a home. 82% of every household in all of San Francisco cannot afford to buy a home.
Hi, everyone. I'm Rana Sarkar, and you're listening to Confluence. Each week, we dive deep into the issues shaping tech, diplomacy, and the economic recovery in disruptive times through the lens of Silicon Valley, Canada, and the world. This week, we're talking to Jen Stojkovic and Margaret O'Meara. Margaret is the author of The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. She and I spoke on what drew her to the history of Silicon Valley, its shifting culture, and the venture capital community that helped kickstart the tech industry here of all places. Later in the episode, Jen and I speak about her work with SF City and how COVID-19 is impacting the Bay Area, San Francisco's housing crisis, and how to revitalize San Francisco in the post-COVID world. Margaret O'Meara is the author of The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America, a book that shows the behind-the-scenes history of the people who built Silicon Valley and shaped big tech in America. She's a historian of modern America who writes and teaches about the history of the technology industry. She and I talked about the history of the Valley. You've chosen Silicon Valley as your topic matter for a treatment like this. What drew you to this material originally?
Through politics, through an interest in American politics, and particularly in the way in which 20th century America grew government by working with the private sector. How the growth of first the New Deal and then Second World War and then the Cold War military-industrial complex was a public-private partnership. It was an expansion of state power that occurred in a way that was different from anywhere else in the world. And I came at to it not as a historian of technology. I'm a historian of business and of politics, of states and markets, and how individuals who are in and lead companies and lead governments, how they understand one another and interact with one another. And historians always love hidden histories, right? Stories that people aren't talking about. When I first came out to the Bay Area, it was 2000. It was the height of the dot-com boom. I was a graduate student. I was embarking on this dissertation project. I was met with, you know, there was a lot of irrational exuberance then. It was starting to calm down a little bit, but it was very hard to find people who, A, believed that the government had anything to do with Silicon Valley story. And more broadly, that had an awareness of the longer origins of Silicon Valley. So this was a missing piece of history. It was a story that was a hidden history that I really wanted to pursue, and I've pursued ever since.
I wonder for listeners if you could describe the origin story, as it were, of the Valley.
Yeah. So let's dial back 100 years. What was the South Bay and San Jose and that area that we now know as Silicon Valley? What was it known for? And this is, meanwhile, like 1920s, you know, San Francisco's a boom town. This is my town of Seattle's a big city. In contrast, with the future, Silicon Valley is known for being the prune capital of America. It grows fruit. That was its claim to fame. It was agricultural. It was another agricultural valley in California. So what changes that? Well, the turn really begins in earnest in the 1940s, when you have a huge amount of military spending that comes to the West Coast. It's followed on after World War II with the Cold War, a vast amount of public spending on military R&D that's very science and technology focused, that has a strong West Coast slant. You know, why is the valley the valley? Why there? Why this particular agricultural valley? Because of two institutions, one that was already there before this turning point and one that came soon after. The one was already there was Stanford. So Stanford's founded in the late 19th century. It's the kind of pet project of a robber baron and his wife. It was not taken very seriously as an educational institution at the very beginning. And by the time you get to the 40s, it is, you know, reputable, a research university, but not the Harvard of the West. Berkeley is still a bigger deal in terms of being a research powerhouse, if you want to go do those comparisons. But Stanford had ambitions of going far greater. And what Stanford had among one of its many assets was a guy named Fred Terman, who had grown up in Palo Alto, son of a faculty member, went to graduate school at MIT. His graduate mentor was this guy named Vannevar Bush. Vannevar Bush, who, among other things, founded Raytheon and is kind of a very important figure in this whole story nationally. But he was appointed by Roosevelt during World War II to run the Office of Scientific Research and Development, essentially run the whole wartime science operation, of which the Manhattan Project that produced the atomic bomb was part. And so Terman goes and works with Bush in the war, realizes that there's something, everything's going to change, that all of this money is going to come online for universities and for research, and we need to get some here. So Stanford, kind of under Terman, who becomes dean of engineering and then provost, and other leaders of the university during the 40s and 50s, they rebuild Stanford as a kind of perfect Cold War university, a place that builds up science and technology and all of these departments that are serving this growing electronics industry that is growing because of military spending. And so that's one piece. The other institution that drives the early Silicon Valley is one that might surprise you. It's the company that was the Valley's biggest employer from the 1950s through the 1980s. And so maybe some of your listeners are like, well, okay, maybe that was, it wouldn't have been Apple, that it wasn't, it started too late. It wouldn't have been Intel, that was in the 60s. Maybe it was Hewlett Packard. Okay, sure. Hewlett Packard was founded in 39. It becomes a big company in 57. No, I'm not talking about HP. I am talking about Lockheed. Talking about Lockheed Missiles and Space, the defense contractor. It's LA-based, but it establishes its Missiles and Space division in the Valley, just 10 miles away from Stanford in 1954. That becomes working with Stanford, those two hubs become kind of the anchors of this growing electronics industry. So by the time you get to the late 50s, you have this small electronics and communications, sort of highly specialized advanced electronics companies that are growing. Most of them are not startups yet. They are West Coast branches of East Coast companies. So that's another thing that kind of goes against the myth making, right? It started out for these big companies. The flywheel gets going, and it gets going in the military industrial complex. Almost all the book of business, all the business that's going on in the Valley has to do with defense.
Margaret and I speak more about how the culture changed over time in the Valley with the switch from defense manufacturing to the venture-backed tech industry.
Talk about the shift in culture in the Valley.
Yeah, it is astounding how much happened in such a short period of time in the 1960s, the change. In terms of the Valley economy and the Valley culture, you see a couple of things happen at once. One is that the baby boomers who are coming to Stanford, coming to Berkeley, are transforming campus culture. And in Stanford's case, there's plenty of activism and protest, some of it directed at the Hoover Institution and the sort of conservative bulwark that's there on campus. An institution that has close ties to a lot of emerging, a lot of Silicon Valley what's not yet called Silicon Valley yet, but the Valley companies. Dave Packard was a chair of the board of trustees of Stanford, was very close to Hoover, was himself a libertarian Republican, kind of a small government Republican, let's say. So we have these political threads that are running through. But you have a very different group of people coming out of the universities of the late 60s who are they may have the training in electrical engineering, exposure to computers, but they are adamant that they do not want to go work for a defense contractor, nor do they want to work on research projects that have to do with the machines of war. And there's, you know, a lot of the protest on these campuses is directed at the government research, the military research that has been, you know, in Stanford's and Berkeley's case, kind of their bread and butter. It's been a major, you know, a lot of defense work is being done, and a lot of the Pentagon is a funder of a lot of what's happening, both directly and indirectly. And the Cold War becomes a rationale for building up these universities, and particularly science and engineering. And so there's, you know, they're saying, how can I'm not going to go work for Lockheed. I'm going to find somewhere else. So that's one reason you end up with a lot of guys at Xerox Park, Xerox's Palo Alto Research Center, which becomes in the 70s, the place where, you know, the graphical user interface, the mouse, Ethernet, all of these things that kind of make the modern computing environment, the desktop computing environment, are kind of laid in this, at this industrial research lab, but that's funded by paper copiers. So it isn't funded by defense money. But the other thing that happens, even though the industry itself, the chip makers, the people who are, you know, the startups that are now more becoming large companies, they are, you know, the defense economy is going away. So you have Vietnam not only turns a whole generation of students against the establishment and the war machine and the Pentagon, but also it, you know, the fund cutbacks in defense funding starting in the late 60s. Totally alters the political economy of the Valley. And in 69-70, Lockheed is laying off thousands of people, and some people are prematurely writing Silicon Valley's obituary saying, oh, well, that was fun while it lasted. Like, what are they going to do? But what's had already taken hold by then was, not only do you have this, you know, incredible influx of human capital, talented engineers who are tinkering around with things like personal computing, but you also have companies like Intel, where the state of the chip making market has gotten to a point where your very sophisticated electronics devices are not, you know, affordable to entities more than just NASA. You have a bigger market, a commercial market you can sell to. One of the advantages of having these large government contracts at the front end, which companies like, Intel was founded in 68, but other chip makers before that had big Apollo program contracts, is you have very expensive devices that, if you have a big order, you can then scale up manufacturing, drives down cost. You know, the laws of economics start applying. And a commercial market is, you know, by the time you get to the 70s, you have chips going in cars and in other machinery. And there's all these other, you know, commercial uses for it. So there's a commercial industry that's already able to grow. So the defense cutbacks don't kind of leave, you know, that isn't the end of Silicon Valley. In fact, it's the beginning.
In terms of incenting the early days of venture capital, you describe in the book a couple of different instances where it was just fortuitous government programming that actually kicked off the venture capital industry in many ways, and then created these sort of network effects out here.
So there was a real problem in the early days of advanced electronics to persuade people with money. And let's say East Coast bankers, who particularly were disinclined to invest in small companies run by young people with no business experience, that may or may not even have an MBA and know how to write a business plan, that are they're building devices that no one really can quite understand outside the industry, that are seem very, very boutique and very blue sky. And it's 3,000 miles away in some agricultural valley in California. If you're a banker in New York or Boston, you're like, I'm passing on this. Like, this is way too risky. So there was a real problem with risk investment. And this was a bigger problem, I think, too, not just with electronics, but other emerging industries. It was just sort of inherently conservative. You know, banking is conservative. It's in terms of it doesn't want to take big risks with its money, wants a more guaranteed return. Venture capital firms and early venture capital pools are kind of come out of this, meeting this need that to find some way for these companies to be financed and they're often led by people who are close to the industry, who understand, okay, there's going to be a big economic upside here. You may not be able to see it, but here, you know, or this is what this technology does. Like, this is what this computer does. Here's a mini computer. This is what it does. And so having some sort of this combination of technical know-how and financial know-how became a real asset. So you have glimmerings of these early venture capital firms, the most famous and earliest being one that comes out of Boston, ARD, which is founded by a Harvard Business School professor, George Doriot, who very, we sort of saw a market opportunity. But in the valley, there was relatively little. And there also weren't people with money. There were Californians with money. And some of the earliest money, other people's money that venture capitalists invested came from land companies, Californian land companies, and old line money, both East Coast and West Coast. For some venture capitalists who didn't have access to large pools of capital, and again, these were young guys themselves who didn't have a lot of connections. The small business SBIC program, the creation of the Small Business Administration, and the creation of these things called small business investment corporations, which was a federal program designed not with technology in mind at all. It was all a kind of brainchild of both Lyndon Johnson was majority leader of the Senate and was trying to get a whole bunch of legislation passed. Dwight Eisenhower was president. He loved small business. So Johnson was interested in finding things that were going to make Eisenhower happy so he could do other things that Eisenhower wasn't as enthusiastic about, including civil rights. And so the SBIC program creates this essentially matching, very generous initially, kind of 2-to-1 match, a pool of money, of capital. So if you brought in $100,000, the feds would give you $200,000. And this became the vehicle that a lot of young venture capital firms got their start with. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And it allowed new people and people who were attuned to this very distinctive market to get into the game. The pool became smaller because it was something that was a little too generous. People tended to abuse it. It was used not just in tech, but in a lot of different industries. Venture capitalists were kind of tried to extract themselves from it over time because it came with a lot of, bureaucratic requirements, as government grants do and should. But it kind of helps create this new industry in a way that I'm sure Lyndon Johnson and Eisenhower never expected. Like, little did they know that this venture capital industry would get its start that way.
After learning more about how the Valley came to be what it is today, we spoke with Jen Stojkovic to learn more about what's happening now. Jen is the executive director of the tech trade association SF City, which is helping to revitalize San Francisco's tech community after the COVID pandemic. We start our conversation with what SF City is doing to help the city recover after being hit hard by the pandemic.
And for those that don't know anything about SF City, I wonder if you can get them a bit of a background in terms of SF City and your role there and what you've been doing.
It changes throughout the years what we've dealt with in terms of tech and the relationship with both the San Francisco community and beyond. So this year in particular with the pandemic, we've really found ourselves providing a lot of COVID-19 response, different tech partners. Early on in the pandemic, we were doing a lot in regards to giving resources. So we provided a lot of product from the different companies. We provided a lot of hardware, a lot of hotspots, and we also provided a lot of tech resources for things like contact tracing and other technological resources that were needed by both the city of San Francisco as well as the governor's office. Later on in the pandemic, it's shifted a little bit. You probably saw in the news in the last few weeks, tons and tons of companies are stepping up to help with vaccine passport development, as well as becoming vaccination sites themselves at some of their companies. So really, like right now, it's all about getting those vaccines out. Same as in Canada, same as in every country right now. The faster we can get them out, the better. And tech has been a partner there.
Jen talks about how tech has had an impact both in the U.S. and abroad during the pandemic.
If you were to evaluate that last year and to say, what do you think the real role of tech has been? Has it been disappointing? Have we seen some real successes in it? Have we over-egged it?
So I think for a lot of Americans and, basically any of the countries outside of Asia to some extent, dealing with a pandemic was very difficult and messy. We have had tech in the wings ready to support for basically since day one, since what was it, March 5th, where we declared everybody go home in San Francisco and we just never came back. Tech has been ready. But I think where the problem laid was that the government and some of the coordinating bodies weren't necessarily ready. So I'd say overall, tech has certainly been responsive and tech has been ready to give resources, but there wasn't necessarily the policies or infrastructure to really set up and use those, right? The contact tracing apps that both Apple and Google have built, that's amazing technology, but it took months for us to be able to deploy them. And we had to deploy them separately, state by state. Let's contrast that to a country like you know, Taiwan, for instance, or a country like Korea. I mean, when you arrive in Korea at the border, as soon as you get there at the airport, you download a contact tracing app. So in the US and in Canada, there's different privacy concerns. So being able to deploy that technology to citizens right away, that was a little bit more of a headache and a lot more entanglement when it comes to privacy laws.
It's worth noting that none of the contact tracing solutions were widely adopted. But fighting COVID-19 isn't the city's only problem. Because the longstanding issues of homelessness and rent affordability were greatly exacerbated during the pandemic, Jen and I talk about the housing crisis facing San Francisco, its impact on the city, and what SF City is doing to help the situation.
Who are the players at the table? And what do you see as the big challenges, particularly when you're dealing with the city and you're dealing with the tech industry? Like, what have you been up to?
So in San Francisco is a little bit different than other cities, right? Because, you know, San Francisco is really more in a defensive place, if we want to be honest, right? San Francisco is trying to defend and maintain its presence as being a tech capital, whereas other cities around the country and around the globe are getting ready to potentially be the next San Francisco. So for San Francisco, I think we have a couple issues at hand. Number one is it is very untenuous and difficult to survive in San Francisco and to get the kind of quality of life in San Francisco that folks are able to get in some of these other emerging cities. A big part of that is housing affordability. We are, as a state, 49th in housing production. There is only one state in all of America that produces less housing, and that's Utah. So we just have such a drastic housing issue in San Francisco that we've been talking about it for years, but it is the number one thing that we need to address if we want to be able to grow the ecosystem so that workers can actually live and thrive in the city. 70% of tech workers cannot afford to buy a home. 82% of every household in all of San Francisco cannot afford to buy a home.
Jen talks about how the COVID-19 pandemic is an accelerant of the usual boom and bust cycles of San Francisco, but it's also of a different type.
How would you put 2021 in the context of previous growings and contractings of San Francisco?
So this is a question that I get a lot. This is a great question. Isn't this just another bust? San Francisco has been booming and busting for hundreds of years, going back to the gold rush. It's okay. It's just another cycle and things will go up again as they always do. That is not necessarily the case this time, because when you use that kind of thinking, you're assuming that business will continue to operate in the way that it has in the last modern era. But we all know with the remote work phenomenon that business and how we do business as a people is changing. We know that remote work is here to stay. To what extent it's here to stay, that's a little bit difficult to answer right now. We're going to have to see what it looks like when life goes back to quote unquote normal. But we do know that that is going to fundamentally shift the boom and bust mentality and what we've grown to expect in the city. The other thing that's really important to note is that we saw a tech exodus in 2001, right? That was the dot-com bust. So in 2001, we saw 23,000 tech workers leave the city of San Francisco in 3 months. 23,000 sounds like a pretty big chunk of people. And it was, right? We had a population of 782,000 people at the time. So that was 3% of the entire population of San Francisco left in a 3-month span. And the city at the time had a $5 billion budget. Okay. So let's think about that. We now in 2020 and 2021 now are looking at about 89,000 to 90,000 people have left the city of San Francisco. We have the data. We have USPS mailing address changes. We have sales tax receipts. We've had a 43% decline in brick and mortar sales tax in the city. So we literally know that people have left San Francisco. That's roughly 10% of our population have left San Francisco. So comparing it to 3% in the summer of 2001, now again, that was a $5 billion budget. This year, we have a $14 billion budget. Almost $14 billion. We have almost triple the size city budget with what is more than triple the exodus of workers.
Public figures have had a huge impact on the city's response to COVID-19. Jen speaks on the response civic leaders have had on the recent exodus of workers, along with the relationship between workers, remote working, and the impact of the pandemic on offices.
When you're speaking to civic leaders here, like, I mean, what kind of reaction are you getting when you're making these points to city leaders?
It ranges. So we have unfortunately had calls, and this has happened as recent as the last month, where city leaders have said to us, well, good riddance, it's going to make housing cheaper for the rest of us. So that is unfortunately one camp, you know, but the other one being people are very, very scared. There are many elected leaders that know that we already are facing a $400 million deficit in our budget. We're hemorrhaging money. We went going into 2020, just for some context, for those that aren't too familiar with San Francisco, before the pandemic hit, San Francisco had a $420 million hole to fill. So we already were not in a spot to deal with this kind of crisis. And so if this really does happen and this exodus does become permanent, people don't move back when the offices reopen, then we are going to deal with a huge hole that can only be filled with deficits and cuts and layoffs and cuts on city services. The last time this happened, we had years of budget deficits to deal with. And so it causes a lot of pain to a city when this type of thing does happen. And unfortunately, this is a magnitude never before seen.
How would you speak to the bigger change of the Bay Area versus the Austins, the Denvers, the Torontos, the Vancouvers, the name your city globally, that concept of the spreading of the tech?
I'll speak to the Bay Area changes first and then talking about some of these rising tech hubs. So in terms of the Bay Area, it's really interesting because we have this new hybrid that's getting popular where folks want to come back to the office, but they only want to come back to the office for one day a week. So that's a big piece of this. You know, folks are saying, if I don't have to be in the office 5 days a week, why don't I go live, you know, an hour and a half like train ride into the city? I only got to go in on, you know, Thursdays or something like that. So I can get a better quality of life outside of San Francisco proper. And then I can just pop in when I need to for meetings. So a big part of that Bay Area shift is those type of workers, right? So those are kind of hybrid, I think we've been calling them so far. So not quite 9 to 5 Monday to Friday workers, but also not fully remote workers either. So that's where I think you'll see a lot of those people. I think it'll be interesting to see. There was like a moment back in June where every single listing in South Lake Tahoe was gone. Like there was just a frenzy of buying that happened in the Bay Area. One of the big cities that saw a big uptick was Sacramento, right? So 72% of all home searches originated from Bay Area folks that were looking to get out of, you know, SF and the Bay Area proper. One interesting thing that happened since that huge surge was the worst wildfire season on record. So that is a precarious situation.
All over the world, climate change has had a devastating impact on communities, big and small. Jen talked about how climate change is affecting not only the Valley, but the state of California as a whole. There's a connection here to how climate change is impacting the decisions of workers on where they want to settle and work.
Most of California is living with an extraordinary climate emergency and a climate crisis in terms of wildfires right now that some suggest is potentially an annual or semi-annual event to have these large-scale wildfires. And how do you think that wildfire effect is changing the sort of terrain for tech companies and for sort of folks in the Bay Area here?
I think Vice President Kamala Harris said it best. In 20 years from now, we won't fight over oil. The wars that are coming are going to be over water. And that is the absolute truth. We know that the drought is very real in California. We used to, back in the day, it used to rain all winter long in San Francisco. It doesn't anymore. We know that the wildfire season is just getting worse and worse. This 2020 was going to be the year where we were going to upgrade the electrical in PG&E. So Pacific Gas and Electric, for those that aren't familiar, a large part of our wildfires happen because we have very bad electrical in the state. And, you know, when we get those dry conditions with the high winds, any sort of spark can set an entire forest on fire. And unfortunately, it has several dozen. They were found liable in court. So there's a lot of things at play here that are really, really building up. And I think that the climate refugee, that's kind of a phrase I'm hearing a lot from Bay Area residents that have left. They simply feel like, what is the solution for California? Like, how are we going to solve it, right?
I'm hearing a lot from folks in the Bay Area that are thinking about Canada as an option and thinking about, and it's not just so that we're, you know, attracting investors or attracting sort of long-term talent or companies and in that traditional investment attraction way, which we are, but it's a bigger existential question as to, you know, where my kids are going to grow up, where I, you know, see the environment being a very friendly environment over the course of many years. And it's a sort of an existential concern that we're seeing. And climate, and it's often sort of the first or second thing, you know, after, you know, sort of immigration and openness and these sorts of things that people are asking about. So it's less about the taxation conversation. And I'm always surprised by how, well, I shouldn't be surprised, but I'm, you know, at least interested in the idea that climate has become such a front of mind issue for people making these big decisions and companies making these big decisions right now. And I don't know if you've seen that in some of the work that you're doing.
Yeah, I would say that you're absolutely right when you mentioned that folks are increasingly thinking about the future of their family and their well-being in terms of the investment and where they want to start a home. We also know that some of these rising tech hubs, like your Austins and Atlantas and even Nashville, those types of places, they're at risk of becoming wildfire-ridden as well in the next decade. In the next 20 years, both Florida and Texas are going to have year-round wildfires too. So even these emerging tech hubs could also, you know, be at stake here when it comes to the climate conversation. And I've heard a lot of folks, you know, thinking about moving up north for those exact reasons. I remember I saw Mayor Tory. I spoke to him a few years back at a conference. It was, oh, this must have been 4 or 5 years ago. And he was telling everyone, his slogan was, "Toronto, cool, not cold." And I think that that's actually, you know, that's actually legitimate. People are starting to consider moving up north for that angle. In terms of companies, you know, I haven't heard too much other than, you know, your Elon Musks and those type folks that are really more set in that space. I haven't heard of too many mainstream tech companies saying that climate is a reason for moving their HQs. But here's the other side of it. I don't think HQs are going to exist for much longer. The recent report that came out at the end of last week from Initialized Capital said 76% of the tech founders that they spoke to don't want to have an HQ. They either want to move to a completely decentralized workforce or they want to move to a hub and spoke model. So there's also a way we could adjust. We could adjust as a people that we don't need to have these giant campuses and actually be able to put people in the cloud, right? And so that could be another way that people respond to climate. Then they can start to live, you know, all over, maybe Minneapolis, St. Paul, maybe Toronto. Like, you know, there's different parts where they can start to work and have good quality of life and escape the climate issues while also still technically being part of these giant companies and being corporate executives.
The founders that I speak to, the investors that I speak to, you know, this idea that you could be a distributed global organization now is very much on the forefront.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you know, we did a poll and people say, what's the best place to start a company? They still say San Francisco. What's the second best place? The cloud. It's definitely, there's a shift in terms of how people are going to capture that magic that happens between spontaneous social interactions and that kind of team building. I had one CEO tell me earlier this week that instead of doing company offsites, they're now going to move to company onsites. And so, you know, every 6 months, every 3 months, everybody's going to fly into an office and that's going to be the way they do it, kind of flip it on its head there.
I wanted to talk to you about your report that you, and what were the key findings?
So we did a report, SF City did a report, speaking to a number of different tech CEOs and founders. We spoke to 82 in San Francisco about what they plan to do in the future of work in terms of their office, in terms of where their workforce will be located. And some of the findings included 55% of tech companies surveyed expect at least 25% of their workforce to remain permanently remote. 36%, so more than a third of folks that we spoke to, expect 50 to 100% of their workforce to remain remote. 63% of companies either have downsized or are going to downsize their office in San Francisco. 59% consider San Francisco regulations, taxes, and policies to be a significant factor to growth. And 76% have changed their hiring plans for the Bay Area because of COVID-19.
When you present those numbers to folks, I mean, what are the ones that really stand out for most people?
The office downsizing. So San Francisco was one of the hottest office markets in the world before the pandemic, right? It is no secret. You would get outbid over and over and over again. It would take you months and months just to even find a floor in downtown San Francisco. For a minute, it was more expensive than Hong Kong and, you know, really, really was difficult to get space in the office market. It was less than 3% vacant before the pandemic. We do not have that anymore. We are, you know, we have empty buildings all over, which is very, very concerning because San Francisco at this point has 14 million square feet of vacant office space, which is the equivalent of 10 Salesforce towers.
What are the conversations that you're having with your constituents in at SF City about, you know, what to do about how to come back to work and, you know, what are the obligations of companies to their space and their location right now?
It's a mix, right? We've had some companies that have fully embraced and said, we're going remote first, like diving head on. Your Twitters, right? Jack Dorsey is unapologetic about moving away and decentralizing from San Francisco. They don't even call it, they don't even have a name for their location in San Francisco. It used to be called the HQ. They don't even call it HQ anymore. So that is one angle, right? The other angle, of course, is folks that want to keep the in-person interaction and they want to come back and they want to fully open their offices. So that's more of like your Salesforce types where, you know, Mark Benioff has been pretty firm. Like he wants to refill all those towers and he believes in San Francisco and he wants his people to stay, same as Jeff Lawson from Twilio. So there's been a divergence among the tech leaders about what the future of tech is. You know, in terms of companies and how they feel about going back into the office, it really just depends on the type of company and the products that they have. I think you're going to see a lot of folks that go all in on leaving and not wanting to have offices anymore. And then you're going to see a lot of folks that, you know, we put our flag down, we want to have an office space. And so it's been a divergence between tech leaders in terms of conversations with our members. There isn't any one clear path forward. There's a couple clear paths in terms of policy goals, though. I can tell you right now, every single one of them said, California's got to figure out how to be competitive on a tax level and regulation level. And that's a whole conversation we can get into. We need to make the quality of life better. We need to make it more affordable. All of those things were true before the pandemic, and all those things are very true now after the pandemic and even more important.
We talked a lot about housing in this episode, and Jen expands on the challenges of building and finding housing in San Francisco.
How would you characterize the pre-existing challenge, pre-crisis?
The housing issue that I alluded to prior in the conversation definitely was an issue before the pandemic hit. We've had a 24% rent drop. So housing is actually, for the moment, cheaper. Yeah, it's gone from $3,600 to $2,500 US dollars for an apartment. So what do you guys think? $2,500 bucks brings us like down to Manhattan prices. Down to Manhattan prices. Not Manhattan right now, but like what it was a year ago. So that just gives you an idea of just how like astronomical the cost of living in San Francisco in particular has become. Part of the reason is because 70% of San Francisco is zoned to single family housing only. So it's illegal to build an apartment in 70% of San Francisco, especially if you're coming from a place like Toronto, where every single TTC stop you get out and there's condos everywhere, you know, high density housing around transit hubs. That's something we've been fighting for 3 years now in California. But they keep fighting and they keep knocking us down. They don't want to build high density housing around transit. Why is that? Well, you know, go down to Hollywood Hills and take a look at where some of the bus stops are. Happens to be there might be some apartments in some very affluent people's neighborhoods. You know, happens to be that there's some very affluent places in San Francisco where they'd have to build apartments. And so a lot of people have been anti-housing for quite some time. That actually, they came out with an article in the Chronicle last week that said San Francisco is the least progressive city in California. And here's why. And it was exactly for that reason.
A lot is changing, but where do we go from here? Margaret and I round out the conversation by talking about the future of the Valley and what can possibly help save the Valley.
And so maybe I can conclude by asking you the bigger question about where do you think we're going now? Like, where does the Valley go today, given, you know, the history that
you've read? Well, I think the thing that the Valley is not going to go away anytime soon. It is extraordinarily resilient. There's still a huge concentration of capital and venture capital in the Bay Area, which is the companies may go, may leave, but the money is still concentrated, and money will go to where will move where the companies are and can invest globally. And we're already seeing these global investment trends. But I do think that you know, for the Valley itself as a region, as for the health of the region, you know, the Valley's got a big equity problem, inequality problem. And that's been evident for a very long time. And it's become abundantly evident in the last decade of extraordinary wealth creation. You see this really vividly in the city of San Francisco. Look, and we're seeing it here in my town of Seattle. We're affected with the same disease, but not quite as severely. And this, you know, we our highs are not as high, our lows is not as low. But this is, you know, and you think about traffic, you think about kind of a functioning metropolitan ecosystem. So what I'm looking for next is I'm looking very closely at what the U.S. government is doing in terms of a kind of turn towards reinvesting in things like in basic science, you know, how they like identifying like these public investments, climate, that are infrastructure broadly defined, universal broadband, all those things, if they do come to pass. And the momentum is pretty extraordinary. It's extraordinary, kind of the just looking from the long view, kind of how the conversation in the U.S. has changed around some of these things. I don't think they're, you know, we should take it all as a given. There's plenty of opposition, but I think this is a real sea change. You know, one of the secrets of Silicon Valley was the sort of the public sector putting its thumb on the scale and encouraging the growth of particular sectors and industries, whether it be microelectronics and integrated circuitry because of the space program. That's what you need to send a man to the moon, is you need a very small, light, powerful microchip, and many of them, or, you know, other things where there are going to be some generative things that move the market and then create space for a new thing to happen, whether it be in California or elsewhere. But it, kind of at a hyper-local level, I think the Bay Area has got some real, not growing pains, but overgrowth pains. It's kind of grown in the wrong way. It's a really difficult place to live for not just kind of ordinary average middle-class people, but for people who are drawing down six-figure tech salaries are having a hard time to find, you know, finding affordable housing. And that's a real challenge for the Valley going forward if it wants to remain the innovation capital it has been so far.
Over the course of the COVID pandemic, demographics have continued to change in the Bay Area. Since I spoke with Jen and Margaret, data has shown that rather than leaving the Bay Area, many folks are now moving around within the surrounding communities. While Silicon Valley may be more of an idea than a physical geography, it isn't going anywhere. The rich university ecosystem and the research nodes that are embedded here, as we learned from Margaret, go back decades and remain strong. This tech ecosystem continues to be bolstered by government funding and private investment in entrenched innovative patterns that are much harder to replicate. Thank you for listening to Confluence. We hope you were able to walk away from today's episode with some new perspectives. Here are a few quick takeaways. The development of Silicon Valley and what it represents has been shaped by powerful institutions such as Stanford University, Xerox PARC, and industries like defense research and manufacturing. Despite obstacles, thoughtfully deployed tech has been a useful tactic to help combat and deal with the impacts of COVID-19, both in the United States and abroad. Thought leadership around the future of work and the need for office space has changed dramatically, even over the last 18 months. We're very much in the first innings of this new reality, with a lot to come. Climate change is a growing factor for worker movement. Climate catastrophes like the California wildfires shape where workers will settle and want to work. This will have a huge impact for tech hubs around the world. The housing crisis is impacting everyone, from low-income individuals to high-income families. There's a striking disparity between the amount of available space in the Bay Area and the access average folks have to affordable living. As tech becomes more distributed and global and moves into the cloud, it may not be necessary to be here in the Bay Area to engage with Silicon Valley. That said, the fundamental science, talent, and deep institutions that support systems of change and innovation and attract long-term, stable capital are here. Finally, there's a case for the specialness of the Valley. Innovation that takes decades, not months or years, to grow, leading to incredible strides such as recent work in synthetic biology, artificial intelligence, crypto, energy economies, and clean tech, are made possible by the unique connectivity that exists here between the commercial and research communities, the private and the public spheres, all coming together in a way that is specific to the history and the culture of Silicon Valley. If you want to learn more about the Canadian tech landscape, we've included some resources in the show notes. Confluence is produced by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Jen Stojkovic and Margaret O'Mara for being my guests. Production thanks to Wade Wallerstein, Kate Walter, Marie Olnick, Yves Beaulieu, Augustus Clark, Steph Colburn, Sophie Shin, and Kanika Codrington. I'm Rana Sarkar. Thank you for listening. Until next time.